Good evening and welcome to tonight's meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, presented in partnership with the Lafayette Library and Learning Center's Glenn Seaborg Learning Consortium. You can find the club online at commonwealthclub.org. I'm Justin Crosley. I'm the founder of the Brewing Network and your moderator for tonight's program. And now it's my pleasure to introduce our guest tonight, William Bostwick. Now, William Bostwick loves beer. I mean, he really loves beer. He's started a career on loving beer. And I guess in some cases on not loving beer because, well, he's a beer critic. Brewers love beer critics. but he's a beer critic for the Wall Street Journal, and his writing appeared in a number of publications and websites, including GQ, Bon Appetit, NPR, and Garden and Gun. He's an avid home brewer, as evidenced by his 2011 book, Beercraft, A Simple Guide to Making Great Beer. And he often teaches workshops on brewing. His current workshop is a series aptly titled Beer Shamanism 101. Yeah. Additionally, William has even raised his own bees in his quest to make everyone's favorite Viking drink, and my throat savior, mead. His latest book is titled The Brewer's Tale, A History of the World According to Beer, and it uncovers the stories of brewers' pasts, the unknown recipes, odd ingredients, and the long-lost flavors, telling a history of the world through the eyes of brewers throughout the centuries. So once again, please join me in welcoming William Bostwick. So, William, we should get to know you a little bit and why you're qualified to write this book about the history of beer. I'm curious when you first got into beer as more than just a beverage.
I guess I first got into it by making it.
My first craft beer was Sierra Nevada. Pale ale, like many people, I think.
Yeah.
And I remember tasting it. I was invited to a barbecue or something. It was the only beer they had. And I remember thinking it was awful. It was terrible. I was used to Rolling Rock and maybe a little Natural Light even. But every place I went to, I had just moved to the Bay Area, and Sierra Nevada was always there. And within about 2 weeks, I couldn't drink anything else but craft beer. The palate just changed. I got into the beer industry about 10 years ago, and since then I've been fascinated with the history of beer in human evolution and as part of our evolution. So I'm curious what you think is exceptional about beer in our human history, as opposed to, say, you know, technology, housing, you know, other things that we can trace along with us. What's exceptional about beer that made you write this book?
Well, for me, beer is interesting because it really gets to the heart of what I think it means to be a modern human being, which is control of the natural world. And, you know, so beer emerged at the same time as agriculture, the agricultural revolution. And that's what kind of triggered all of what we think of as, you know, modern civilization, settled living, cities, grain-based diets, etc. And when we started domesticating grain, we used it for beer and bread. And there are even some anthropologists and scientists who say that we actually first made beer before we made bread. And if you really think about it, they're basically the same thing. It's just, you know, one's a liquid and one's a solid. But the whole idea of beer as turning a wild grain into a domesticated grain and controlling this magic of fermentation and using that kind of wild fire to our advantage and trying to figure out how we can manipulate it, which is something that we're still figuring out to this day. I mean, when we get into, you know, wild bacteria fermentations with different wild organisms like sourdough and that kind of thing, there's still a lot of unexplored territory there. So this is a quest that we're still on. But I think beer, more than anything else, really gets to the heart of that idea, of that kind of seeing the magic in nature and trying to capture it and control it.
Okay. There's a lot of theories about where fermentation came from. In fact, one of the predominant theories is that mead was one of our first fermented beverages. Most theories revolve around how fermentation happened accidentally. There was some form of sugary water, maybe grains left in a pot out in the rain, which then started to naturally ferment. So,
well, yeah, I mean, that's just it. I mean, if you take, you know, if a sugary fruit falls off a tree into a puddle, that puddle will become wine, whether a human being touches it or not. But if grain gets wet, it won't become beer. There's a whole process that needs a human hand to turn that into beer. You have to malt the grain, which means you have to convert its starches, which are undigestible to both yeast and human beings. I mean, if you just like eat a handful of rice, you know, it's not gonna work out too well for you. There's a process called malting where you basically steep the grain in hot water. You kind of like make oatmeal, and that extracts the starches and turns them into sugars that we can digest and that yeast can digest as well. And that's how we'll ferment it. So yeah, it's easy to say that, you know, wine or mead, these naturally occurring sugars were the first fermented drinks because we don't need to do anything to them. But that's what makes beer so special, is that it needs us.
Absolutely. And I would say we need it. So you said something in the introduction of your book, which is no indication about how far through I got in your book, by the way. But I really liked it because it, again, goes along with how beer has affected human history. You said, "Tell me what you brewed and drank, and I'll tell you how you lived and where." Can you explain that a little bit?
Sure. I mean, the thing about beer in the past was that it was very much a reflection of place. And these days, you know, you said you moved out to San Francisco, out to California, and Sierra Nevada was everywhere. Well, now Sierra Nevada is everywhere all over the world. You can get that same beer. And Sierra Nevada is a craft brewery. And talk about Budweiser. You can get, you know, a can of Budweiser pretty much anywhere you go.
Yeah.
But in the past, beer was really a local endeavor. And you used what grew around you. And you brewed it for yourself and your friends and your family and your neighbors. And so, as with any kind of locally made, locally produced, locally consumed item, it was really a reflection of that place and of those people who made and used it. It was brewed with what they had, and it was brewed to their tastes. And tastes have evolved just as we've evolved. You know, these days we like bitter things. We kind of see it kind of emerged with coffee in Victorian England. We kind of see the sophistication in the sharpness of bitterness. Whereas in the past, you know, bitter meant poison, and so beer prior to the influence of coffee and black tea was really sweet and kind of syrupy because we liked sweet things because we didn't know how to refine sugar, so sweetness was scarce. It reflects what we're interested in, what we like, what we can grow, and what we need from our foods.
And you go on to say that it's still doing that today.
Sure.
I mean, yeah. The craft beer revolution that we're seeing, it's a few years old now, almost 20 maybe, but it's still relatively new, and it's evolving literally yearly types of beers that we see, hoppy beers. Even mead making a bit of a comeback now, this ancient beverage that's now appearing again. And I think it is a reflection of us as a changing society. So I'm curious, in your research, if you can teach us a little bit about maybe what are some of the key differences between the beers that we're drinking today and some of the ones from our ancestors that you discovered.
Well, I think what I said about place is really that's really the key difference, is that today brewers, professional brewers, and home brewers as well, and there are a few notable exceptions, one of whom is sitting right over there, order their ingredients from major ingredient suppliers, big, you know, grain farms and maltsters and hop growers, and everyone is more or less using the same stuff to brew what they brew. But in the past, that was very much not the case. If you happened to be living and brewing in a place where hops didn't grow very well, you didn't use hops. You couldn't, you know, get online and order a crate of hops to be shipped to your farmhouse in Norway. You would use, you know, cedar or juniper. Likewise, you would brew with whatever grains you could grow. And, you know, today it's mainly barley and wheat, but there is, you know, a plethora of different grains and sugar components that people used in their beers. So that was the main difference, I think, was really the variety of ingredients in the past, because beer has been made pretty much everywhere on Earth, and everywhere on Earth has its own unique flora that we would use to make the beer. So every beer would taste different based on where it was made. Another big difference that we don't always think of is that beer in the past was typically drunk pretty fresh. In fact, sometimes even while it was fermenting. Beer, especially in ancient times, Mesopotamia, and going back that far, was just kind of a standard household item. Like, you know, you would imagine your Italian grandma having kind of an ever simmering stock pot of tomato sauce on the stove, or, you know, your house growing up with a coffee pot just slowly congealing into sludge on your countertop all day long. Well, in Babylon, that was a kettle of beer that was just always bubbling in the corner, and you would add more barley to it and drink a little bit and add a little bit more and drink a little bit. And so beer was really just kind of like a everyday sort of our daily liquid bread. It wasn't something that you would go to the store to get, or even really go to a bar to get. It was very much made for home consumption and consumed relatively fresh with a lot of yeast and a lot of sediment. And it was really kind of a meal unto itself, not so much the more refined kind of, you know, sparkling, clear, crisp, super cold, tasteless, sometimes refresher. We think of it today.
Some of the beers I drink still taste like meals.
Yeah. Well, yeah, as we start to embrace the kind of the rich history of rich beer,
yeah.
A lot of these craft beers that we're seeing today are, yeah, pretty strong and pretty powerful. And that's because, you know, if you think about what life was like in, say, Victorian England, if you were a factory worker and you had, you know, a couple minutes to get a quick bit of sustenance in the middle of the day and couldn't afford to go out and get a, you know, piece of steak, a big, you know, thick, hearty glass of beer that you could down and then get back to the factory was, you know, good enough.
Yeah. It would have been great in college, too, for all the same reasons. In your book, you use characters to describe the different components of the history of beer. And each one is a section, each character. And you use modern brewers to describe these characters in some of them. You mentioned one that's here tonight. His name's Brian Hunt. He's with the Moonlight Brewing Company, and he appears in your book in relation to the shaman, which I think is the perfect description for Brian Hunt, because he has this philosophy of local beer as well, and a theory that if it's not grown locally to him, that maybe he shouldn't brew with it. The first time I ever interviewed Brian, I asked him if he would make a German Pilsner, and he looked at me like I was crazy. And I thought, well, why a German Pilsner so common? And he said, well, I'm not in Germany, are you? But you use him as the shaman in the book, and you talk about the historical shaman. Can you describe this character in the history of beer? Because he's fascinating to me.
Sure. One of the things that beer was in the past and is no longer today, except with people like Brian Hunt, is I kind of hesitate to use this term, but it really is accurate, especially historically, a spiritual tool. If you think about the impact of intoxication on human development, I mean, the first time a human got drunk must have been a remarkable thing. Truly. Yeah. I mean, because how do you explain this transcendence?
It probably felt like magic.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And in addition to that, a lot of the herbs and spices and flavorings that were used in beers in the past, many were medicinal, especially in the Middle Ages. You know, their beer was medicine. It was used to cure everything from herpes to the plague to rabid dog bites. If you put, I think, whorehound in beer is for a rabid dog bite. And I don't know what cured herpes.
Nothing.
you know, beer was a medicine, and to some, especially in the Nordic cultures and the cultures with a shamanic religious history, which means a religion involving kind of a spiritual leader who is more of a gatekeeper into another kind of spiritual dimension, the shaman. Beer was, a lot of these herbs were not just medicine, but some were actually narcotic. And they would brew beers, different shamans would brew beers with things like fly agaric, which is that famous white and red speckled toadstool mushroom, or different hallucinogenic herbs like henbane or mandrake. And these beers were what anthropologists call entheogens, which is a Greek word that means to create the divine within. And the idea would be that these drinks were kind of portals into the spiritual world, and we would understand, you know, mortal living by transcending it into some kind of other realm. Now, that's getting a bit heady.
You make it sound like I was born too late.
Yeah. Well, the truth is, you know, I think that there is still some magic, and it might not necessarily be hallucinogenic magic, but there is some magic in using what you have and using what grows in the land that you're living on, and not making a German Pilsner because you're not in Germany, and instead making a, what do you call it, Brian? A California black lager instead of what it would be called, what a similar beer would be called in Germany, a Schwarzbier, a black beer, a black lager. Using the ingredients that you have, brewing to the tastes in your community. I think there is something magical and transportive and shamanic about that.
I want to go back just a second and talk about alcohol, this part of beer. And I don't know if you agree with me, but it seems to me that in the West, we're a little bit shy about talking about inebriation and
alcohol. Yeah, very much so, yeah.
We're not shy about talking about beer. We're not shy about calling it a social beverage and using it in social events, but we're a little bit shy about talking about the effects of alcohol, when really some of them, like you've mentioned, are wonderful. Like the first person who must have felt this, all of a sudden he was happy. His or her mate was probably better looking. There are several things that are real parts of this beverage.
Right.
Do you have an idea why we're shy about talking about that part of it?
I do and I don't. I mean, I do, yeah, in one part because, you know, there are a lot of, intoxication poses a lot of dangers. And, you know, beer as a drug, and I mean that both in the medicinal sense, like I was just talking about, and in the, you know, intoxicating sense, can be abused like any other drug. And so,
sure.
there are a lot of problems with that.
Yeah.
But as you say, you know, part of its history as a social beverage is really tied to the fact that it's inebriating and the fact that it dissolves social blockages and social boundaries. And beer was always something that throughout history was always something that was shared, and it was always something that brought a community together. And you really still see that today. I mean, you think of things like, if you remember, what was it called, like the Beer Summit, you know?
Yeah, Obama and...
Exactly, and the police officer sharing a beer, and
yeah.
You know, it's still this kind of like get your, you know, your friends and enemies to sit down at a table over alcohol, over a drug, and that is something that we kind of don't like to talk about, but it is a really important part of it. And you know, I got a lot of it's very easy to joke about,
sure,
you know, and I got a lot of you know, snickers and laughs when I would tell people about this book that I was working on, saying, oh, you know, you must have a hard time reading your notes at the end of the day, and you know, all that sort of stuff, which is all true. But I think that kind of misses the point. I think the more that we really kind of understand the meaning and the use and the value of intoxication, the more seriously we can think about it and deal with it and understand and treat its destructive causes.
Sure.
As well.
And I certainly don't want to encourage irresponsible drinking or irresponsible behavior, but I think that goes across the board. Don't be irresponsible in general, including with your alcohol. Let's talk about your research a little bit. You did just mention, it's a funny joke, that you might not have been able to read your notes at the end of the day. But sometimes when you're out doing interviews with, say, Brian or Jim Cook maybe from Sam Adams, you're spending some time with them. Surely you're tasting beer. Is this a unique writing experience for you, having to taste beer all day and then be able to deliver?
It is... Yes, it is a challenge. I mean, I will say, you know, that being a beer critic, yeah, you it's challenging in a number of ways. One, you got to drink a lot of really bad beer.
That's a challenge.
And another is you got to remember what you drink after having drank a lot of it. And that's a challenge too. But yeah, the research for the book really came, there are really three components of it. And one of them was just that, finding the modern, today's equivalent of this ancient brewer whom I was trying to meet over a glass of beer. So when we talk about the Nordic shaman, I found him reincarnated in Brian Hunt. And so I went out and spent a long and beer-filled day talking with Brian. Or in the industrial brewer, who I found reincarnated in Jim Cook at Sam Adams, and spent a lot of time with him talking about what it means to be an industrial-sized brewery today. Another part of the research was just, you know, long beer-less days in the library, just digging through old recipes and beer histories and food histories and agriculture and that sort of stuff. And that, you know, I'm a scholar at heart, I think, and there's some romance to that. But the most fun, the most interesting part of the research was the third part, which was making these beers at home myself and figuring out, really, you know, what did ancient Egyptian beer taste like?
Yeah.
Because that was really one of the, you know, you asked at the beginning, you know, why beer? Well, for me personally, why beer? Because I can make it. And, you know, if I want to figure out what life was like in the past based on one thing, you know, I don't know how to build a pyramid, so I can't figure out what life was like in ancient Egypt based on how they, you know, where they lived, but I can make beer, so I can figure out what they drank. And that was my kind of, that was my window in, that was my glass in.
So let's talk about that, because a big part of the book, as you describe the different characters and different eras, was that you sought out an ancient, sometimes recipe, and then brewed it yourself.
Yeah.
Anything come to mind that was the most unique or even challenging to brew?
Yeah. There are a lot of answers to that question, because, you know, everything was really unique. A lot of these beers I had to kind of piece together from, half translated old German recipes that I couldn't quite figure out. You know, George Washington's handwritten scribbles in the back of a notebook trying to figure out a beer recipe from that. And, you know, there you have to draw the line somewhere when you're recreating these, a lot of these beers, because, you know, I brewed an ancient Egyptian beer, for example, that used dates and honey and unmalted grain, a lot of like raw wheat and barley. And in ancient Egypt, they would brew it in kind of like a tandoori oven, almost like a hole in the ground that would get hot, and they would bake these loaves of bread on the walls of the pot, and then steep those loaves in hot water, and that's what they used to brew this beer. Now, I don't have a yard, let alone a clay oven in the ground.
San Francisco,
so,
really?
Yeah. So I was like baking these loaves under the pilot light overnight in my oven, and you know, I was doing the best I could. So everything was a unique experience in that sense. But I did have some surprisingly delicious discoveries. One of which, the one that really comes to mind most, was a Victorian era porter. So, you know, I talked about the kind of industrial era London factory worker having his lunch in a pint glass. And what that lunch was, you know, we often think of today as like, you know, a Guinness. But in the past, you know, these beers, we hadn't really figured out sanitation. And these beers were stored very often in wooden barrels. And wooden barrels are porous. And as the beer sits in that barrel, the barrel expands and contracts, and air gets in, and bacteria gets in, and maybe an insect or two gets in. And after a couple of days or weeks, that beer starts tasting a little different than it did when you first brewed it. And often it's going to taste a little sour. And today, when, you know, sour beers are becoming, like you say, you know, you see the craft beer scene evolving year to year. This year, sour beers are a real, you know, cutting edge style, a real trendy style. In the past, pretty much all beer was more or less sour because we couldn't keep it from going bad. And one of the most interesting beers I made was a British porter that was half fresh beer, so half unsoured beer, unaged, it hadn't gone bad yet, mixed with aged beer that had kind of soured a little bit. And that flavor of, if you can imagine, half kind of the roasty crispness of, you know, a Guinness or a fresh porter, and half the kind of funky sourness of what we think of today as sour beer, or even imagine like that kind of sweet sour, like balsamic, if you've ever had like a really nice balsamic vinegar over ice cream, that kind of blend of sweet and sour. That in beer was fascinating. I'd never tasted that before until I made it myself.
Okay. We've got some questions from the audience, too, that
Great.
I'd like to sneak in here. This one is good and simple. Define beer.
Beer is a drink made from fermented grain.
Good. Simple question, simple right? answer. as we know it today, it also generally has, just to elaborate slightly, generally has four ingredients, which is water, hops, malt, and yeast, which were defined was defined by the Germans in a beer purity law called, you'll remember this, the Reinheitsgebot. And now we don't really follow the purity law anymore. Some German breweries still do, but other ingredients can be put in, just like you've been talking about. I did want to ask, just as a follow-up to some of these recipes that you've done, if many of them included hops, because hops is something we know as one of the four ingredients now, and they're so popular.
Of course.
But yeah. It's relatively recent, right?
Almost none.
Okay.
Almost none of the recipes included hops, because hops really, we've only been using hops in beer for the last maybe 500 years. And of that, hops have only come to dominate beer. I mean, nowadays, pretty much every beer you see on the shelf has hops in it. That really only happened in the past few hundred years. But before that, hops were, if not used because they just didn't grow where you were brewing, often hops were actually seen as bad for you, as a poison. Hops are genetically related slightly to cannabis and in fact are a sedative. And so hopped beer was kind of was a downer. And, you know, compared to a lot of the more invigorating, medicinally kind of warming beers that a lot of medieval brewers were making, you know, full of warming spices like ginger and, you know, nutmeg and allspice and these exotic flavors that were seen to be not only really valuable and sophisticated because they came from, you know, these far distant lands, but also really good for you in a kind of cold, wet, dreary age. Hopped beer as a kind of put you to sleep sort of drink was not very popular. So really only when beer started becoming an internationally traded commodity did hops come to dominate beer recipes. And that's because the bitterness in hops comes from an acid that's very antimicrobial. And it'll keep beer fresher longer. So when we started trading beer and shipping it over long distances, fresh beer was really a financial imperative. And if it took hops to keep that beer fresh, well, that's what you were going to use because that's what would sell.
Okay. Here's a question that I get a lot, and I think it's an important one, especially among us self-proclaimed beer geeks, because we can just assume that everybody loves beer, and they don't. This question comes in and says, I enjoy wine, and I like exploring beer, but have really not developed a beer palate. Can you suggest some local craft beers that I should try and what I should taste in them?
Yeah, you know, that's actually a really good question. And people ask me that all the time. As a beer critic and also I bartend every once in a while at a friend's brew pub, and I often get that question, you know, I don't have a palate. I don't have a good palate. I don't know what I should be tasting in beer. Well, everyone has a palate. There's no such thing as a good or a bad palate. What I think many people don't have is the vocabulary to talk about what they're tasting. I think beer can often be a very daunting world to dive into, especially now that the craft beer world is kind of a swirl in so much hype and trend. We think that beer has to, talking about beer, we have to use these certain terms. We have to describe it as hoppy, or we have to like hops, or it's not okay that we don't like hops, or what's a pilsner, or I only like lagers, or I like dark beers, or I don't like dark beers. There are these certain kind of go-to terms that we feel like we have to use. Whereas I feel like it tastes like what it tastes like. So what I would suggest, if you're a wine drinker and you're trying to get into beer and you want to know some local craft breweries to go to, I would suggest all of them. And I would say try all their beer and just wing it. What does it taste like? You know, I've had beers. To me, I'd take a sip. You know, that tastes like red licorice. That tastes like red vines. That tastes like Dr. Pepper. That beer, I had a beer the other day that to me, it tasted exactly like, you know how when you have pud thai with the lime in it, and you squeeze the lime over the pud thai, and then you eat the pud thai, and at the end you have the lime that has kind of soaked up some of the oil and some of the peanut, like, and that combination of the citrus bite and that like umami kind of peanut like creaminess. I had a beer that tasted like that. And that's something, you know, that's not something that you get from having a palate. That's just, you get that from having fun with it. Trying to figure out what is it, not what is this supposed to taste like, not what am I supposed to taste in this, but what does it taste like? And do I like it?
I think it's also important to define what it is that you're not enjoying about beer when you say you haven't developed a palate for it. And most often, it's bitterness. I heard a theory very recently in an interview I did with another author, and the theory was about hops. And the theory is that hops are known to have high amounts of estrogenic components in them, lots of estrogen. And for that reason, many women are turned off by the taste of hops. And they might not know that they're turned off by the taste of hops, and they certainly don't know that it's because they're drinking a glass of estrogen. But there's just a theory that if there is this kind of consensus among females, and there are exceptions to every rule, that that bitter beers aren't working for them, that there might be a scientific reason for it. And part of it was, we don't need any more estrogen. So one thing you could look for, if it's bitterness, I don't know who asked the question, is definitely go toward more English-style beers, which you'll find to be a bit sweeter. A lot of people who don't like beer are afraid of dark beers. They think that dark beers are bigger in alcohol or might be thicker in body, and that's not true at all. In fact, a Guinness is one of the lowest alcohol beers you'll probably find on most tap lists, and it's actually quite dry. So don't be afraid of the color of beers either, but it would help to define what it is you're not enjoying about beer to then go to every brewery, like William suggested, and find ones that you do like. So you interviewed Jim Cook from Sam Adams.
Yeah.
And Jim Cook's a fascinating individual. He has 2 degrees from Harvard, and so he's a fantastic businessman. He's a great brewer. He's built the largest craft brewery in the U.S. Is that right? He's number one now?
Yep.
The biggest? So a question came in from the audience. This person said, I first had Sam Adams in Boston in 1987. I had never heard of it before.
Oh, wow. That was one of the first.
Yeah. He says, after 7 of them, his wife had to pull him away. But the question is, as you interview brewers, what are the differences you find in their personalities between the ones that are content to stay smaller and local and the ones that are out to become the biggest craft brewery in the world?
Well, I don't know if it's fair to say that anyone is out to become the biggest. But, you know, to take Jim Cook as an example, you know, I don't think he started Boston Beer, or as it's colloquially known as Sam Adams, to be the largest craft brewery in the world. I think he started it to make great beer. And as a businessman, he sees greatness or quality in terms of consistency. And to him, a great beer is a beer that tastes the same whether you have that Boston Lager in Boston, a mile from, you know, at Doyle's Bar, a mile from the brewery, or here in San Francisco, 3,000 miles from the brewery. If it tastes the same and it tastes good, that's a quality product. And so to ask Jim, who are the best brewers out there, he's not going to say, you know, some tiny little mom and pop startup where every batch is unique and every batch is different. He says Budweiser, because you can have a can of Budweiser here. You can have a can of Budweiser in Johannesburg, South Africa. And like Andy Warhol said about Coca-Cola, it's going to taste the same. And I would argue, not only a power to that, but a beauty to that as well. This mastery of what for so long was considered magic, that we can do it the same every time, everywhere. So the question about, you know, are some brewers out there to be small and are some brewers out there to be big? Yes, I think that there are some brewers who stay small purposefully to traffic more in hype than in quality. And I have a very big problem with that. But I do feel like the larger question of, are there brewers who, you know, do they want to be big or do they want to be small? I think really it just gets down to, what do they see as, how do they define quality? And are you defining, you know, quality as consistency, like a guy like Jim Cook does, in which case you're going to grow and grow and grow and be more consistent and more, invest more in research and development and technologies? Or do you define quality, for example, like someone, as someone like Brian Hunt does, which is something that reflects its place and its time? And in that sense, you know, this year's batch of a beer that Brian Hunt makes called Working for Tips, which uses redwood twigs, this year's batch is going to taste completely different from last year's batch, because this year's redwood twigs are different from last year's based on the rain and the sunlight they're getting and all that. And to him, that's quality, the inconsistency. And that's why Brian Hunt is not the biggest craft brewer in the country, but still one of the best.
These are some of my favorite parts about your book. Are these, in my opinion, surprises that you find? As craft beer fans, it's very popular, and very often you'll hear us make fun of the larger breweries, the Budweisers of the world. And in the book, you hear brewers like Jim, and I know this of many other brewers, really compliment them on being some of the best brewers on earth. They make that style of beer, and they make it very, very well. And there are a lot of surprises like that, like finding out there's a brewer who's putting redwood tips in his beer. It's fascinating. At this point, I'd just like to remind our radio audience that you're listening to the Commonwealth Club of California radio program. I'm Justin Crosley, founder of the Brewing Network, and your moderator this evening. Our guest tonight is beer critic and home brewer William Bostwick, discussing his new book, The Brewer's Tale, A History of the World According to Beer. And where is our timekeeper, just so I know where we're at? Thank you. Okay. Here's an interesting question for you, William. What are your views on non-alcoholic beers? Came from the audience.
Well, I'll say two things. The first thing is broad and philosophical, and the second is not. The broad philosophical thing is that beer is by nature fermented, and fermentation produces alcohol. And alcohol and beer are one and the same. And making beer without alcohol goes against what beer is. So in my mind, non-alcoholic beer is not beer. That's the big philosophical thing. The other thing is that I just haven't had a non-alcoholic beer that actually tastes good. So I don't like them.
I would have just started and ended with "I don't like them." If it had been posed to me. Here's another question from our audience tonight. With large macro breweries, which are what we call the Anheuser-Busch and the Miller Coors of the world, losing market share and a proliferation of craft breweries popping up each day, where do you see the future of the American beer industry?
It's a great question, and everyone's kind of scrambling for an answer to that, especially the macro breweries, who are not necessarily losing market share, but they're kind of plateauing a bit. I don't know. I mean, there are some who say because there are so many craft breweries and little tiny craft breweries opening up these days that we're in a bit of a bubble, and the market for craft beer is so ravenous. At a certain point, we're going, our taste is going to catch up with our appetite, and we're going to realize that a lot of these tiny little breweries that have been opening up, that have, it's been pretty easy, and I say that in a relative sense, for them to be successful because so many people are so excited about new craft beer, they might not be making actually good craft beer. And when we start kind of becoming more discerning in what we're drinking from the craft world, some of those little startups might fall by the wayside. And we'll see craft brewers like Sierra Nevada, like Boston Beer, like Stone or New Belgium becoming bigger and bigger and bigger and kind of edging into macro beer territory. Meanwhile, there are all these little startups happening. And so I wonder if the future of beer is somehow balanced or split between hyper-local on the one hand, where, you know, it's I live in San Francisco. I can drink beer made blocks away from my apartment. And that's a pretty incredible thing. And I think there's going to be more of that in the future. And I think that's great because that gets back to what I was talking about in the beginning, to this, the root of beer being this locally made, locally consumed, locally shared product. But I think there's another side to the future of craft beer in the U.S., which is, like I said, the brewers who we once thought of as craft because they were small, now becoming kind of too big to be considered craft because of size alone. So we're going to have to redefine what that term means. You know, for a long time, we defined a craft brewer as making 1 million barrels of beer a year or fewer. But Sam Adams pretty quickly got above that limit, and the Brewers Association bumped it up to now I think it's 6 million barrels. Now 6 million barrels compared to what Budweiser makes is nothing. But 6 million barrels compared to what Brian Hunt makes is a hell of a lot. And so is a brewer like Jim Cook just as much a craft brewer as Brian Hunt? Well, that gets, you know, that kind of enters a tricky linguistic territory here. So, yeah, I don't know what the future is going to hold. I mean, I hope and I think it's going to hold a lot more great beer, at least.
The size of craft beer is very interesting, especially the way it's grown. Jim Cook's favorite joke when people say to him that he's the largest craft brewery is that's like saying I'm the world's tallest pygmy. It means virtually nothing. I'm still, it's still less than 2% of the market share of all the beer sold in the U.S. The Brewers Association reported, my numbers may be a little off, but not much. There's something like 3,000 craft breweries in the U.S., just in the U.S. right now, which does mean that the local brewery is really coming back, much like local food. Do you see a parallel with this slow food movement and farm to table and craft beer?
I do. And I hope that that parallel becomes more explicit. And by that I mean, you know, even the local brewery that for me, you know, happens to be a few blocks away from where I live in San Francisco, you know, they use hops that are grown in, you know, I just had a beer that they made with hops that were grown in New Zealand. Now, if you put that to that beer to the slow food movement, well, there's nothing slow about shipping in hops from New Zealand, but so I hope that as local beer kind of gets evaluated on the same with the same criteria and on the same terms as local food, we start seeing an increase in brewing with local ingredients, locally grown hops, if you can grow them, and if you can't, locally grown mugwort or yarrow, locally grown barley, if you can grow it, or and malt it, and if you can't, something else. I hope, and I think that that'll kind of blow the doors off of flavors and styles of beers and kind of open us up to tastes that we haven't been able to taste for centuries, since we've been kind of mired in this, those four main ingredients that you mentioned earlier.
We've repeated some of the same beer characters throughout the night, but you interviewed several for the book. Were there any other interesting craft beer people that you ran across in your research?
Oh, yeah. I mean, you know, the craft beer world, it's a great community of, it's kind of part nerd, part geek, part mad scientist, part drunk. And that combination is just, I mean, everyone was a character in their own right. You know, there's this guy I met in Philadelphia, this guy Rich Wagner, he's one of those historical reenactors who, like, even in his modern day clothes, you'd say to yourself, that dude looks a lot like Ben Franklin. And, you know, so when he's on the job, he, you know, wears his tricorn hat, and he has this horse-drawn wagon that in the back of the wagon, he has this brewery, this like portable colonial American brewery that he made. And he like carts it around to different reenactment sites around Pennsylvania and brews beer over an open fire. And I met him at a brewery, and he gave me a beer that he had made that he had put in an old Gatorade bottle. Because he didn't have any like bottling equipment. He was like, try this. And it was this unlabeled Gatorade bottle with this kind of like slightly translucent yellow sort of liquid in it. And I'm looking at it thinking to myself, like, I've seen bottles like that on the side of the road. I don't know. But
I like that all of his get-up and his equipment was true to form, yet he was using a plastic Gatorade bottle.
Yeah, exactly. He dug into his, like, you know, hand-tooled leather mail pouch and pulled out this Gatorade bottle.
Yeah. Couldn't find, like, a pig's bladder to serve
it
or something?
No, yeah, that's what... Yeah, well, I don't know what I would rather drink, you know, what I would rather drink out of.
Right. All right, here's a question that I really like. This person says that I enjoy pairing food with wine, and that it brings out the flavor of the wine. Do you find the same with beer and food?
Oh, yeah, and definitely. In fact, if you think about it, you know, maybe even more so, there are some who say that beer is a better beverage to pair with food than wine, simply because there are so many more tastes and flavors available in beer, simply because there's so many more ingredients involved. I mean, wine is just grapes and sometimes a bunch of chemicals. And beer is, it could be a, you know, really richly roasted barley beer, or a really light and zesty wheat beer, or a beer made with spelt. And that's just the grain. That's not even mentioning the flavors you get from all the different kinds of hops and herbs and spices that are used. And so I would say definitely experiment with pairing beer with food. And like I said about developing a palate and a vocabulary and tasting beer, just wing it and have fun with it. I mean, I found some of the most fascinating pairings have been some of the most unexpected. For example, a super, super sour red beer brought up to room temperature, which is not something you do every day with sour beers, paired with a really nasty, stinky cheese is just, you would not believe how well that works together.
And it make just, it sound really appetizing.
Yeah, yeah. And it just does. And that's something that I would not have even discovered if I hadn't, you know, happened to leave my beer out too long and let it come up to room temperature. But having that, the warmth bring out the sweetness of the beer that kind of accentuated the sweetness that kind of lurked behind that musky kind of basement foot flavor of the cheese. It really, like, those kind of discoveries are things that I think pairing beer and food is all about.
Yeah. A simple one, and it works with wine too, but I found that it works fantastic with beer to start with, is chocolate and beer.
Yeah.
And chocolate and almost any beer, it just they really complement each other. It's just a small place to start.
Right.
I would also encourage you, a lot of, you know, sometimes there's this competition between wine and beer, but beer people and wine people that really get it know that there isn't a competition, that we're both making great beverages. And sometimes you'll hear it on the radio or you'll see it during our own San Francisco Beer Week, where they'll do a wine versus beer dinner, where they get a great vintner and a great brewer, and they're pseudo competing against each other throughout the night for the best pairing. And it's so fun to find out the differences between wine and beer and how they both go great with food. So just keep an ear out for that. I'm curious, now that you know what you know about our evolution with beer, especially after all the research you've done, have you ever thought about what our lives would be like without it?
Well, yeah. I mean, if we didn't have beer, we wouldn't have had. If we didn't have agriculture, we wouldn't have beer. I mean, I guess we'd be nomads eating. we'd all be on the paleo diet, I guess, for one thing.
So, that would be unfortunate.
Know, we'd all be. Yeah, we'd all be really healthy barefoot runners.
yeah.
But what our lives would be like without beer? They'd be dull.
Yeah. Did you have any brewing disasters, or for that matter, just terrible beers that you brewed during this process?
I had very, very many. So many, okay. So many. Some of them disastrous in the sense, you know, I've had beers explode on me. I've had beers, burst their bottles, leak out of the fermenters. Beers that just tasted so bad I couldn't drink them. Beers that tasted so bad I couldn't even, you know, usually what I do with beers that are too bad for me to drink, I mix them into bread, or I cook beans in them or something. Beers that were too bad even for that. An early beer that I made, one of my earliest attempts at this ancient Egyptian beer, I used date pieces, and one of the date pieces, as it was fermenting, bubbled up and got stuck in the airlock of the jug that I was brewing the beer in. And now what I had wasn't beer, it was a bomb. And so that didn't work out too well. A lot of my more interesting failures came when I started experimenting with wild fermented beers. I started brewing with my sourdough bread starter, and brewing with, you know, trying to catch wild yeasts and wild bacteria from the air and use them to brew beers. And that's where, you know, I got into that territory of, is this bad or is it just me? Like, is there someone who would say, like, yes, that cheese that tastes like, you know, like a rhinoceros toe jam is the best cheese I've ever had? Or does it taste like rhinoceros toe jam and is awful? So that was, you know, that was kind of interesting in the sense of, is it a failure or is it a brilliant failure?
Right. Could be both.
Yeah, could be both. But, you know, yeah, there were plenty of beers that are best left to the sands of time, I think.
All right, here's one that I think was started by a comment in a newspaper by Jim Cook, and it's a question delivered
to me from
the audience, who's clearly worried about how they're going to feel tomorrow morning after our tasting. As the question is it true that if you eat one teaspoon, I think it's a teaspoon, of yeast with plain yogurt while drinking beer, that you can drink lots of beer without getting drunk?
Yeah, you know, that's a question I get asked a lot. That specific question, yeah, I think it was Jim Cook who said that was his, like, hangover cure.
I think his is like a teaspoon of yeast with every beer he drinks.
Right, right. But, you know, every culture, this is a fascinating world into itself. Every culture on Earth has its own kind of magic hangover cure, from, you know, pickled herring to green tea to yeast. Everyone has kind of their own magic bullet, and there is some truth to every one of them, really. I mean, yeast, if you think about it, there are a lot of B vitamins in that, and that's good for you, and that might help you, you know, metabolize some of the alcohol a little bit better. I find that, you know, a big bowl of menudo the next day is a better choice. And I don't think science needs to spend a lot of time figuring out why that's a good idea. But I don't know. I mean, if you can stomach the taste of a teaspoon of Fleischmann's on your yogurt, I guess, why not?
Go to town.
At least you're eating something while you're drinking, right? I mean, that's probably the real thing that's going to get you through the night. Some food in your stomach.
Well, unfortunately, we've reached the point in our program where there's time for one last question, and I'd like it to be an audience question. I have one in front of me, and I think with all the talking we've done about the growth of craft beer and where it's come from and where it's going, this is a pretty valid question. And they ask, where in the world do you currently see the greatest opportunity for a new craft brewery?
Huh. That's an interesting one. You know, there are scenes, craft beer scenes emerging all over the world. Japan has a really kind of burgeoning craft beer scene. You were just in Australia. There are a lot of really interesting Australian breweries coming out in New Zealand and London. But to end on a more kind of poetic note, I will say, in your own home. I think the future, the real future of craft beer, the real future of beer, is people figuring out how to make it themselves at home and really reclaiming it as a homemade, homegrown, enjoyed with friends, enjoyed with family kind of a drink. And that's what beer always has been, and that's what it should be.
And with that, our thanks to William Bostwick, beer critic, homebrewer, and author of the new book, The Brewer's Tale, A History of the World According to Beer. We also thank our audience here, on the radio and online. I'm Justin Crosley, and now this meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California is adjourned.